Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it's a great privilege to be here to discuss with you this copyright infrastructure, but particularly the notion of enabling creativity. And I intend to use a lot of images in a very short time. So as we would say, please fasten your seat belts, and we're about to go off on a presentation that will cover 5 points. First, there is, I believe, a very profound knowledge revolution, more profound than anything humanity has witnessed since the invention of writing, even older and more important than printing. And I will give you what I refer to as the 7 pillars of that knowledge revolution. It will change everything in the world within the next 30 years. Secondly, we have to rethink the law of the land, the international law as well. Third is to come back to a question of what is copyrightable, because there seem to be a lot of misunderstandings about that as well, and I will bring you some rather quirky and unusual cases. And then I will say a few words about inventing the future, which this conference is all about. And so every time I will come, I will discuss some of these issues. You will see sort of individual red slides like that show you that I'm moving to the next topic, and I'm also getting closer to the end of my presentation for those who are worried. So let me proceed first and say that we all know that the web started with somebody producing and then somebody consuming. We are now at Web 2.0, where people are both producers and consumers. Not only of emails and material, but also of videos on YouTube, images on Flickr, etc., and they participate in social media as well. But the next step is the semantic web, which people have been working on for quite a while, which will identify relationships and not just objects. In parallel, social connectivity is growing extremely rapidly. We all know about Facebook, the enormous success of Facebook. So if you look at the degree of information connectivity going up this way, there's the web here and the semantic web coming later on. And if you look at the degree of social connectivity, you will notice from the web we now have the social software connecting people, including Facebook and the like. The question is, what happens here? The meta web. And Novak Spivak, who did this diagram, is asking, what are you connecting there? Is it knowledge? Is it people? Or is it people and knowledge together, a form of collective intelligence? But whatever it is, it's going to require totally different thinking about what happens in that quarter, and more change will come. So what's happening immediately beyond tomorrow, it's difficult to predict. So what are the 7 pillars of that knowledge revolution? First is the parsing, life and organization of knowledge. Parsing meaning that we used to have, whether they were scrolls or codexes, manuscripts are printed, you had books, individual volumes that, like bricks in a wall that you're building a structure with, are parsed, and they are dead. If you have the same book I have, we open page 157, the first line will be the same in your book as well as mine. Close it, 10 years later, we reopen it, they'll be exactly the same unless there's a different edition. But if I refer you to a website, by the time you look it up 2 hours later, it may already have changed. It's alive. It's a very different type of medium that's happening. So the web pages are now the new parsing, and rather than have complete structures, the web is constantly emerging and changing. So yesterday the document was dead, knowledge was presented in a certain way with an introduction, a problem statement, a methodology, marshaling evidence, analysis, interpretation, conclusions, and then references and bibliography. Today it's alive, it's updated constantly. We have a home page, short introductory statements, we connect with hypertext links from that short page to other places, and you have sitemaps, search, browsing, etc., and we also introduce images and video. Tomorrow is going to become even more fluid, more continuous. All documents will be alive, underlying concepts become part of the fiber of the text, 3D imagery will be with us, and the entire system will be alive, not just individual components in it, especially when the semantic web comes online. Already, as a librarian, I'm debating with my friends that we should not just stay with the old definitions of topics. You can drill down links, see how the real links are between different disciplines, based on how people are actually using the information on the web. So these links, this is a map of the social sciences, this is a map of the natural sciences, based on the actual utilization and self-referencing that is taking place. So rather than simply following the Dewey Decimal classifications of topics the way that we have had it for centuries, we actually have an evolving structure of the classification of knowledge as well. And beyond the conventional keyboard and screen as interface, there's augmented reality, there's providing information where it's needed, in this case, to a medical doctor looking at an emergency. And we can see that the entire world will become a living, vibrant, changing, interconnected knowledge base, similar almost to a brain that covers the whole planet with neurons firing all the time, all over the place. Very different image from the cumulative bricks or the cumulative parsed way knowledge used to go. Secondly, of course, image is going to play a much bigger role in the future. We can see, of course, the efficiency of looking at the picture rather than a long description of what the pine cone looks like. We can do things and understand and see inside the body. We can see submicroscopic images. We can see beyond the spectrum of light, in this case temperature, and we can use it also for diagnostics. And you can do things with images that you couldn't do otherwise. This particular map of the Tokyo subway, I would say to somebody, if you tried to describe it by text, you couldn't do it. So you need images for it. And also vicariously, I haven't been in space, but I travel with astronauts thanks to pictures. The third issue is that with the exception of pure math and philosophy, every other field of knowledge, humans will need machines to access, retrieve, manipulate, and add to the body of knowledge. The amount of information is so big. You will not be able to work in any field without the mediation of machines. And the ubiquitous computer is now being replaced by supercomputers and handheld devices as we enter into a new realm of computing. And effective machine translation is coming very soon. At the Library of Alexandria, I'm working with a lot of people on these issues, so that's another topic that's coming. That will expand the brain's reach beyond anything our parents could imagine, while in parallel, the search for artificial intelligence will continue. Note, in terms of processing power, our most powerful computers, which at present are in the teraflop range, just getting to the petaflop range, the human brain is still a million times more powerful. The question is, what will happen when the computers will be a million times more powerful than the human brain? And just to remind you, they had less power when they went to the moon in 1969 than you have in your average iPhone. So that's how far computers have come in the last 50 years. Fourth is complexity and chaos. There's an emerging science of complexity and chaos, which I will not talk about, but fundamentally it requires different mathematics and different paradigms than what we've been used to dealing with before. Fifth is that computation and research will merge, because we are no longer just doing data collections. We're looking at connections between data collections, which raises a whole set of different types of questions of enormous complexity. And the people who've been doing a lot of work in that area are computer scientists. Now, what will all this lead to? New computer architecture, new pathways, clusters, network control, neural nets, multidimensional manifolds, virtual communities, and so on and so forth. Where is it taking us? I wouldn't dare predict. And if anybody feels that they can predict the future, to get some humility, try to say who would have predicted how far the internet would have changed the world 25 years ago. So, six is convergence and transformation, meaning that the conventional fields of science are converging and creating new areas of science that didn't exist before, and transformative research is changing it. Now we have BINT, which means girl in Arabic, but actually I use it, bio-info nanotechnologies are merging. You know, we used to have chemistry and biology, and then we have biochemistry that emerged by certain convergences. You still have chemistry and you still have biology, but you also have biochemistry. And now all of these technologies are merging, and the fields of knowledge themselves are changing very rapidly. And transformative research is what is really capable of changing the field completely, as happened, for example, with DNA discoveries, which changed biology completely. Finally, we need pluridisciplinary status. We need the knowledge and insights of the social sciences. We need the wisdom of the humanities and not just the knowledge of the natural sciences. So with the world changing so rapidly, we need to rethink the law. My father's time, he would have never imagined that there would be a question about whether someone was alive or dead. I mean, it's either alive or dead. That's it. Well, actually, today we all know that this is a major issue, and you can keep somebody, by some definition of alive, very long, and who gets to pull the plug on the machines when, under what circumstances. All of these issues are created because new technology creates new issues which require new law. And given what I just said before, I think when it comes to access to knowledge, we will have to think of new law. So digital technology is making sound, pictures, and text all viewable and copyable on an unprecedented scale. Actually, it already exists. You can download movies through your mobile phone and look at them through these glasses. Digital future is unstoppable, and therefore trying to protect old business models against the new technology will not work. But let me say that copyright law, like any law, is there to serve the interest of society, not to maximize the profits of any particular group of people. And that's, I think, an essential. We pass laws not for the interest of a particular group of people, but for society as a whole. And therefore, we give certain people certain privileges because it's in the interest of society to give them those limited privileges. So what are the fundamental principles? Well, there's a social contract between society and the creative people to give them rights for a limited time. It's a monopoly on rights for a limited time in exchange to encourage more of this creativity. But there's also the interest of maintaining the public domain, the public interest, not only public goods, but access to knowledge being protected at all times. So if you look at the social contract and for a limited time, I think, for example, that we find that the American Constitution, and I will come to that in a moment, in copyright has been much abused in spite of the fact that in its first article it does mention copyright. But in protecting the interests of the producers of knowledge, we are undermining the rights of individual citizens. The law in France, the three strikes law in France, fundamentally does not respect the presumption of innocence, because somebody told, you downloaded material, I'm warning you a second time, third time, boom, we cut off your internet for a year. Now, wait a minute. I've been accused of something, I should have the right to defend myself. There is a presumption of innocence that's built into any legal system. And certainly, you can't take the word of the accuser against the word of the accused by any legal system. And it really does not accept the evidence that there are large errors of false positives in these machine-based policing systems that have been used everywhere in the world right now. But let's go back to basics and ask some questions. What is copyrightable? Actually, even in the United States, which is very, very aggressive in defending copyright, you have to think a little bit about that. There's a beautiful article by Susan Cornfield, and she's here with one of her cats. She has three cats. Cats will come back into this story of copyrights. And she points out, she's a professor of copyright law in Michigan, and she says there are classes of content that are not copyrightable, entire classes. Facts, data, unoriginal collections of facts or data, ideas, concepts, principles, processes, algorithms, features, functions, elements that can be written in just a few different ways, research, because copyright does not allow ownership of knowledge per se, theories and interpretations of history, content due to external requirements, computer models, titles, short phrases, slogans, recipes, ladies who want to cook, men who like to cook, recipes cannot be copyrighted. Incidents, characters, or settings which are in a practical matter indispensable for a story. But the Supreme Court made a very clear distinction on what is copyrightable in an 1884 case where this photograph of Oscar Wilde was reproduced without the permission of the photographer Saroni, and the Supreme Court ruled in his favor because it said although the picture was produced by technology, and the camera and the chemicals, and the subject was a public figure, the posing, the lighting, and so on, was a creative work of the artist and therefore could be done. So the technology can enable the embodiment of choices, but does not itself make any creative choice. And the copyrightable expression is the one that is limited to what the creative choices were. But then you can reproduce it in different formats. So some interesting examples. Take this. Bridgman Art Library photographed some of its works. In this case, that's the Bridgman version of Vincent van Gogh's The Diggers. And it put it out in its catalog. And Corel copied that material and sold it on CD-ROM. And Bridgman sued that they had copied their picture. Well, Corel won because the courts held that there was no creative work in copying Vincent van Gogh's image. I mean, the creative work was Van Gogh, not digitizing a picture of Van Gogh, because in fact you could see there's no difference between this one and that one. And therefore, that slavish copying does not constitute protection similar to the one that Saroni got in the case of Oscar Wilde. Now, there's a lot of slavish copying going on the web and on the internet, and therefore the limits of what is really being protected is the Creative Choice Act. Okay, now we come to cats. It's an interesting story. This is Cooper the cat, and he takes pictures. They've attached a camera to him that goes off every now and then, and he goes around and he takes pictures. And the question is, do his owners have copyright of the results? Actually, no. Because like a patent that has to have an inventor, the creative act has to have a human author. That's what we call author's rights in other places. So Cooper doesn't qualify. Okay, how about this one? That's another interesting one. A theory of feline aesthetics. And as you can see, it turns out with YouTube that actually cats like to paint. So what happens here? Well, actually the text of the book and the picture of the cat painting are covered by copyright. But the painting itself that the cat is doing is not. Because so far, at least, the ruling is that the author has to be human. But it's an interesting definition. So that shows you that, you know, there are subtleties in what constitutes the creative act that we need to reflect to. Okay, much more direct. This is a case where Manny Garcia took this photo, and then Shepard Fairey did this poster with Hope, and then there was a suit that this picture, this poster had been taken from this picture. And the suit was not adequately defended anyway, and the ruling was no, it's all right, because look at this picture taken by Steve Jurvetson, which is a totally different picture from this one, but fundamentally it's the same person with the same attentive attitude. So the fact that it looks a little bit, in terms of the angle, like this picture, well, there are other pictures that could look just like it, and therefore there is no infringement of copyright in using that pose of Obama in a creative work. There is, the poster itself is copyrightable, but the author of that picture, in fact, was saying that his copyright had been infringed. So all of that simply to say that things are not as straightforward as some people would imagine. So let us move a little bit forward now and say, okay, that's where we are. How about if we want to invent the future, which is what this conference is all about? Well, the internet, of course, has been one of the most transformative innovations of the last century, if not in the entire history of humanity. These two guys, both good friends of mine, actually are the real inventors of the internet. Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn invented the TCP/IP, which is the Internet Protocol. And Tim Berners-Lee founded the World Wide Web and the inventor of the HTML and the WWW. So these three guys have done more to change the world than all the political and military leaders in history. And they deserve a lot of credit. But what they have created is a challenge for us to redesign our systems of governance and our system of administration and our business models to deal with it. There's an enormous amount of information on the net, but it's of variable quality. It allows us to communicate at the speed of light. And it gives enormous opportunities for creative individuals and the private sector. Just look at the youth of people like Larry Page and Sergey Brin, who founded Google, and who are now leading an enormous book digitization program that is challenging all our concepts in terms of relationships between libraries, publishers, authors, etc. We have to invent new business models. And regretfully, the music business has been like a dinosaur that is trying to defend an old business model against a new technology. And the publishers are following in their footsteps. While on the other hand, a lot of innovative business models have come, but surprisingly, not from the music business and not from the publishers. Apple iTunes, the first truly suitable business model to the new technology. And it came from Steve Jobs. Aside from inventing the iPod and the Nano and cool stuff like that, he actually had the system of Apple iTunes, which was that you can have legal downloads that are paid for one by one using the new technology. So the business model doesn't try to prevent the people from using the new technology. It allows the new technology to be used in a way that would compensate the creative people and the copyright holders in a way that is fair and just for everybody. Of course, he went on and gave us handhelds from this to the iPad, and electronic books are now the future. Now, interestingly enough, when you think of the electronic books on the future, well, who invented that? It was Sony, the e-reader, which Sony is an electronics company. It was Kindle from Amazon, which is a retailer, and it was the iPad and the iTunes store or library that allows this on a massive scale. Traditional libraries like Borders in Washington and New York has closed down, and others have gone out of business because they're not adjusting their business models. So all of these business models have come from inventors, from people in electronics, from people in retailing, but we need them to come from the creative industries themselves, and that's what's still missing. This is something I look at with great ambiguity. The world's first bookless library, October 2010. This is the Engineering School, University of Texas, San Antonio. It has 425,000 books online and 18,000 electronic journals, and they've actually taken all the paper material off the shelves. The world is changing. Electronic books are the future, and we can't stop it. We have to design new systems to deal with it. Well, what if I want to not just download electronically like the case of iTunes? Well, there's a print-on-demand system, which is quite nifty, actually. And the business model works like this. There's an author and a publisher, and together they've produced content, which is put in an electronic store. There's a machine maker who creates a machine, and a space owner where the machine can be put in place, like a mall or an airport or whatever. And now the user comes and queries the machine. The machine gets material from the electronic store and prints it, gives it to the user, who has swiped his credit card, which then goes to a bank, and the bank actually sends out the payments to all the actors that have participated in it. And that's a business model suitable to the new technologies. And as you can see, it compensates everybody. So we want a win-win-win solution here. And it exists. I had the second prototype in the world installed in our library, where you can select a book from the catalog, out pops the finished book, instantly readable. You can do that for print if you want a print version of what you get otherwise. Now, even educational services are changing. Professor Sebastian Thrun of Stanford, he gives an introduction to artificial intelligence, and he said he was going to open the course for registration from around the world, not giving a Stanford degree, but giving a certificate for those who complete the course. He had 130,000 students registered immediately around the world. That's the drive for access to knowledge. And it shows, therefore, that technology today is there to do things that could not have been done before, that our parents couldn't dream of, that therefore we have to have the boldness to invent suitable structures to go with that enormous transformation. Now you will be talking about private registration and documentation and everything that can be done with that and rights management and so on, but there's a whole panel dealing with that, so I won't deal with it. Let me get into new roles for government. The founding fathers in the United States were very much against monopolies and against censorship. Jefferson, of course, has this famous word on his memorial in Washington, D.C., and the Madison, who was the prime author of the Constitution, he knew the history of copyright as a tool of censorship in Europe, and they wanted to assure that U.S. copyright would not be used for censorship. So there's an interesting debate between them in their correspondence about that they should give creative people an exclusive right for how long? For a limited time. And Madison wanted it to be for 14 years, which was similar to the Statute of Anne in England, and Jefferson said, no, 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 it's too short. Let's make it 19 years, 18 and a half, rounded up to 19 years. So we have one talking 14 years, one talking 19 years. Copyright. Less than the 20 year of patent later on. Now, it's written in the U.S. Constitution, in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8, to promote the progress of science and the useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings. For limited times. It never said that a copyright holder can hold it forever if it's a corporation, or if you start to think in terms of the extensions that we have done beyond the life of an author, they are very big. I, in Egypt, wanted to publish a poem by Abbas al-Aqad that he wrote in 1922. Well, it turns out, even though it were only 50 years after author, I still can't. He died in 1964. So basically, I can't publish it till 2014. Now, if Aqad was alive, he would not be particularly happy that I couldn't use his poem to give to a group of children, or not children, young students, and I had to use some other text, which from Manfaluti, because he died earlier, simply because of these enormous extensions of the longevity of copyright. So the idea of holding it for during certain times is important. In the first Copyright Act of 1790, it was 14 years copyright, and then only for the residents of the United States and citizens. It was extended only in 1831, so almost 50 years later, and 40 years later, and only to citizens and residents, which meant that the United States was a huge pirate of British material during the 19th century. And Dickens, for example, found his Christmas Carol pirated in the US. But the US at the time said that they were a developing country and that they really couldn't afford to extend these privileges. They were kind of arguing what we today call limits and exceptions, I believe. But anyway, they succeeded in that, and things changed only slowly. So in 1831, it was taken to 28 years with a renewal of one more 14 years after that. 1909, 28 plus 28. 1976, author's life plus 50 years. 1986, author's life plus 70 years, and now 75, but commercial copyright is held in perpetuity. So the original intention in the Constitution by the framers was certainly for a limited time. That just underlines that we have to go back and think in the lightning speed of what's happening today in the definition of what's copyrightable, that we have to rethink the regulation that's required, not just in terms of orphan works and libraries and archives, but also the nature of the legislation, and specifically for educational material, specifically for developing countries. There should be a public registration and legal deposit system, which today doesn't exist for digital material, but we need to do it, just as we have a national depository to get copyright in books. And of course, governments have to play a role in dispute settlement and enforcement. So the infrastructure to enable access to knowledge, well, for one thing, of course, open access and licensing is important. There's an Open Content Alliance, there's the A2K campaign. There are other campaigns. The general idea of putting at our fingertips the ability to connect with the knowledge of the world. Harold Varmus, very distinguished Nobel laureate and founder of the Public Library of Science, who says he puts everything for free there because knowledge should be free to the whole world, and other things of that nature. But we have huge problems that are barely beginning to appear in the preservation of digital content. And that's part of the government responsibility. And only the archives and the libraries are really thinking hard about this. And I mean, There's technical obsolescence and physical obsolescence. Now, this is an old-style storage of information, and this is new-style storage of information. And there will be new forms of storage that are evolving beyond that even. Old-style retrieval of information, new-style retrieval of information. Need I say more? We need to go beyond that also for international agreements. Countries are not the same, their problems are not the same. England and the US had different approaches at a certain moment in time. Question for us, what do we do for developing countries, what do we do for others? First, I suggest that we need to go back to basics. The fundamental principles, the innovators, authors, and artists must be the primary beneficiaries. For example, Superman, famous picture. This was invented in 1938 during the Depression. During this enormous revival of the films, actually, Joel Schumacher and Jerry Siegel, who invented Superman, got nothing. They were living in poverty in Chicago, and the public was very annoyed with them. So in the next film, they gave them a small consultancy. Why? Because the copyright had been transferred to a corporation, and it's the corporation who made the deal with the films, and it got all the money. But the artists themselves got nothing. I think artists should have rights in subsequent resale of their work. An artist that you buy a painting for $1,000, then 10 years later it's sold for $1 million, and then 10 years after that for $10 million, he only got the $1,000. He should get 5% of every resale during his life or her life. And after all, you pay Christie's or Sotheby's the 6% to auction the stuff. Why shouldn't the artist who created it get that 5% or 6%? So the producers, printers, traders, distributors must be remunerated, but they should be remunerated for their services by a certain margin on the sales. Material must enter the public domain quickly to benefit society at large. Why is there a continuing monopoly on the characters that Disney created, like Snow White in 1938 or Mickey Mouse at that time, to protect the creativity of whom? Actually, it turns out that the creativity went to Pixar with Steve Jobs and to DreamWorks with Jeff Katzenberg and others. It didn't stay in the corporate structure of Disney. And Disney himself, when he created Snow White, that won the Oscar in 1938, he went to the Grimm brothers because it was a tale that was known and was in the public domain. So we need to bring back issues in the public domain. We need open source alternatives. We need to recognize fair use for non-commercial exploitation. We need artistic use to be nurtured. If I do a collage with lots of little pictures, as was said in that story of Oscar Wilde before I showed you the cats, Oscar Wilde and Saroni, it's the creative part, it's not the public figure or the technology, it is the creative part. So if I take small pictures and I do a collage with them, that's the creative part. Take Louis Armstrong. He was hailed as a genius. And what he did, he listened to a lot of things and then he merged them in his mind and he produced his own music. Today, is this guy Armstrong's heir? Is this another Louis Armstrong? But he mixes and matches using computers and digital music, because this is how it's done today. Except that today we say, oops, wait, you use this part, which is copyrighted, and use that part, which is copyrighted. Armstrong was doing it in his mind. He does it with machines. I submit it's the creative part that counts. Not he produces something new, and that's what's required. New technologies need new solutions, and global connectivity is here to stay. So individual country registrations will only help so far, and that brings us, therefore, that we have to look back to what we're going to do on a global scale, and we'll need limits and exceptions for developing countries. So the digital future is here. Change is happening with incredible speed, and I invoke you to be bold in your thinking in this conference, because I'm convinced that working all together, there is so much we can do for a whole generation and for the whole world. And I thank you for your kind attention.